Thank you, Lisa. I want to take a moment first to thank the members of the alumni office who made this weekend happen, and I particularly want to acknowledge and applaud Jennifer Soster and her crew in the alumni office for these full and happy days. I also really want to thank the alumni volunteers. I ran into one of them last night at the Duck, and she goes, you know, it's a lot of work. So, thank you all very much. I also want to now acknowledge all the alumni who have returned to DePauw for this weekend. I firmly believe, indeed I know, that DePauw is made stronger when alumni return. For beneath all the tents and besides all the runs to Marvin's is the reaffirmation of the central tenets of this university, that we are a community, and that we're made stronger when we convene and reconvene, converse and reminisce. And in a world of electronic connections, there are rare moments when we can make real connections and reconnections. It's just these connections that I hope you remember about DePauw and that you feel this weekend. And perhaps having a garlic cheeseburger at Marvin's may not seem like the most profound thing you do this year or next, and maybe having a beer or two at the Duck may seem unimportant, but at some level it is important. Unless you ordered a light beer, then you really aren't contributing. As you may have seen in the program for this morning's event, my talk is entitled Welcome to DePauw. And even though I've been here nearly a year, this still feels odd to me. How is it that I'm welcoming you, the alumni, back to DePauw? How can I be welcoming you when I've just completed my freshman year? So I thought I would begin today by offering a few reminiscences of my own first year here at DePauw. As I've said in a number of venues, one of the first things I wanted to do this year was to listen to DePauw and to learn from it. So I made that my first and my most important task. As just one part of that effort, I arranged this past year to have dinners in every dining hall as well as in every fraternity and every sorority on campus. This was either ambitious or this was foolish. Now, it turns out having dinners or sororities is easy. A pattern emerged after a first few of these evenings. I would arrive at the house and ring the bell. I would inevitably be greeted by the sorority president at the door. The president is always named Kate or Sarah. She greets you with a firm handshake and she looks you straight in the eye. She majors in sociology and her mother is very proud of her. Kate or Sarah then introduces you to the scholarship chair of the sorority. She is named Elizabeth. She majors in biochemistry, and she wants to go to IU Medical School. Her mom is proud of her, too, though she wonders if Elizabeth is studying too much. You are then led to the dining room where you meet the house mom, and where you inevitably eat a dinner made up of a large salad with dressing on the side, a piece of chicken, and a Diet Coke. You talk with all the sorority sisters who are all wearing pearls. You thank them for a nice evening, then you go home. Dinner at the fraternities is different. You go to the door, but instead of nice music coming out from the windows, you always hear the brothers scrambling inside the house as you're walking up the path. At the door, you're met by the president of the house, who's always named Matt. He always is wearing khakis and a blue blazer. And instead of introducing you to the scholarship chair, you're introduced to the rush chairman, who always has a nickname, like Mojo, or Flounder, or Skip. He is wearing a rumpled dress shirt and a rumpled tie that was found on his roommate's floor 12 minutes ago. The other fraternity brothers are assembled in the living room, and they don't know quite what to do with themselves now that the president has walked into their house. So they stand there and they punch each other. This is true. Somehow you manage to move this group to the dining room where you serve steak. Most of the guys think this is basically a good deal. You could steak at the price of putting up with the president. So, during the dinner, the fraternity brothers who have been selected to sit at your table convince you that they study all the time. Then you go home. This seemed to be a very nice, comfortable pattern. I was pleasantly making my way through all the houses during the school year, and it all seemed like a great idea. I was proud of myself. Then came dinner at Sigma Nu. I was prepared for the typical night when I walked up the path to the house. I knew, though, that things were different when I walked in the front door. Instead of a group of fraternity brothers hanging back awkwardly, I was greeted instead by a very excited group of young men standing right inside the door. The fraternity president, to protect the innocents, I'm going to call him Joe today, greeted me with the big news. Dr. Casey, guess what? We have a special surprise for you tonight. We're making turgusen. What is turgusen, you ask? I, too, was baffled. Joe, the president, then led me and all the brothers into the kitchen where I met another Sigma Nu who was acting as a cook for the evening. The kitchen wasn't clean, I want to point out, but let's call the cook. We'll call him Chuck. Chuck then explained to me and all the gathered brothers how one makes a turgusen. You start with a large turkey, let's say a 25 to 30 pound bird. The night before the dinner, you completely debone the turkey and lay the bird flat on a table. Then you place a layer of stuffing and a few sticks of butter on top of the now flattened turkey. Then you place an entirely deboned goose on top of the turkey. Apply another layer of butter and stuffing, then you place a deboned chicken on top of the goose. With string and some wire, you reassemble the bird, so now they now look like a very, very large turkey. You put this in the refrigerator and you prepare to cook it the following morning. Chuck, the cook, explained that they had followed all the assembly instructions perfectly the night before, but somehow, because they had slept late, they had started the cooking process somewhat later than was ideal. Chuck, the cook, then signaled the two freshman pledges to get the turgusen out of the oven. The two pledges went to the oven and pulled out the bird, or should I say birds, that were sitting in a makeshift pan. Unfortunately, the amount of fat these birds produce, combined with the butter, had filled up the pan. As the pledges brought the birds to the table, waves of fat spilled across the dirty kitchen floor. One of the pledges proceeded to slip to one knee, but managed to keep his hands in front of him. Somehow they managed to get the turgusen to the table. Chuck the cook then produced a meat thermometer. He then noted that he had read on the internet that you should never serve poultry at anything less than 150 degrees. Look, he said, pulling the thermometer out of the and putting it in the middle of the bird, it's nowhere near 150 degrees. He then took the meat thermometer out of the turgusen, wiped it on his corduroy pants, and put it at one of the ends of the bird. Look, he exclaimed, at this end, it's very nearly 150 degrees. A cheer erupted from the Sigma Nu's gathered there. Joe, the president, declared the turgusen cooked. The two pledges then picked up the pan, brought the turgusen into the dining room. Chuck, the cook, then produced a large knife and proceeded to carve off a roughly 6 to 8 pound serving and placed it on a plate. Joe, the president, turned to me, handed me the plate, told me to sit down at the head of the table, and said, Dr. Casey, would you please do us the honor of eating the turgusen first? Ladies and gentlemen of DePauw, esteemed alumni, graduates of this fine university, prodigal sons and daughters, return to Greencastle to celebrate your reunion. I have spent nearly my entire professional life on a campus preparing for this position. I earned many degrees. I wrote a dissertation. I learned about budgets and management. I learned about working with faculty. When offered the position of the president of DePaul University, I studied all the histories of this grand institution. I had, in short, covered every contingency. I was ready. But when faced with a slice of tepid turducin, I knew I had reached a fork in the road. My very relationship with DePaul hung in the balance. The future was set before me on a plate. Ladies and gentlemen, DePaul, esteemed alumni, graduates of this fine university, sons and daughters of Greencastle, I want to tell you what I did next. I looked at these fine young men, and I thought about the 172-year history of this old university. I thought about the students. I thought about the generations of alumni. I thought about the traditions, the boulder, the moan on bell, the sing-ins. I thought about the faculty. I thought about the Board of Trustees. I thought of the 18 presidents who had gone before me, President Simpson and Humbert, Presidents Rosser, Kerstetter, and Bottoms. Ladies and gentlemen of DePaul, I'm here to tell you that I ate the turducin. There are so many more moments I could describe, much less dire than this, of how one can listen to DePaul. I can tell you of the Sunday suppers I had with students. They could sign up in the union during the week, and the first 10 who signed up would have Sunday supper with me at my house. I can tell you about the time I auctioned off my house for a sorority pool party for a weekend. And I can tell you about the thousands of ways in which I try to reach out and meet DePaul to listen to it. But in addition to listening to DePaul and meeting the faculty, the students, and the alumni, I took it as one of my responsibilities to think about how DePaul might move forward, building on what is unique and strong about this institution and seeing how it might be stronger. Three important conversations began this year and continue despite some pressing economic challenges of this year. First, in my very first meeting with the faculty, I asked them to think about what changes or enhancements that could make this place the most exciting place to live and learn in this country. And if I didn't have that level of ambition for DePaul, you should ask me to leave. I suspect that when you think about what you learned at DePaul and how you learned at DePaul, you remember a small, intense community in which you knew your professors. You remember long talks with them and with your fellow students, and you remember eating with your faculty members in their nearby homes. You remember talking with each other and engaging in a real debate. So when I speak up to alumni, they always remember a level of engagement that was striking. There are many ways you can encourage such engagement when you can make students learn in vibrant ways. There's also a large number of ways in which you can get this wrong. It's been quite a long time since we as an institution have looked at our curriculum, our requirements, and our majors, the ways in which we ensure students know how to write, to speak, and to think. It's also been a long time since we asked how DePaul uniquely and well balances the liberal arts with preparation for one's career. The Indianas and Michigans and Northwesterns of the world, the universities that have programs in accounting and engineering and dentistry, may have an easier time of explaining themselves than DePaul does. But I assure you, and I'm echoing what Joe Allen said, the liberal arts institutions actually prepare you much better for the long run than our pre-professional peers. We just have to make sure we educate our students extraordinarily well, and that we are clear what we say we are, and how clear in how we prepare our students. So this year, our faculty and administration is taking a very deep look at what it means to educate students for our times. The next major conversation has to do with the nature of our campus and the ways in which we connect and don't connect to the town of Greencastle. One of the essential features of a liberal arts college is the size of DePaul. A college of the size of DePaul is the ways in which we run into each other, in which we learn. The Ohio State University covers approximately 15 square miles. It has parking for over 45,000 cars. Arizona State University just announced its intention to enroll 100,000 students. Penn State has one dormitory that houses more students than DePauw's entire student body. At schools of such scale, students are offered a variety of courses and a plethora of degrees. At DePauw, our small scale sets us apart, and it's our strength. We believe that we learn from each other in a small community. We believe that learning most earnestly happens when it's enmeshed in a tightly woven fabric of community. The question is, does DePauw's campus support this? We've become rather far-flung. DU is over 2 miles away from the Ethics Institute. Our athletic facilities and over 20 apartment buildings are across a very busy highway. Yet we have very few gathering spaces in the middle of this campus. We have to now think about the ways in which we can enliven the center, in which we can ensure that we quite literally run into each other. We also have to work with Greencastle to make sure we have the type of college town, and you all know what these towns can be like, that will help us attract the strongest students and the strongest faculty. So we have just brought in one of the nation's leading architectural firms to look how we actually use this campus and how we can make it feel richer and more connected. And the town of Greencastle is very much part of these efforts. The third and final major planning conversation is a new effort to tell our story better. A year ago, when I was named DePauw's president, I had just completed a several-month interview process with a search committee, during which I learned a great deal about this university. At the end of the process, when I made my first speech to this campus, I noted by how stunned I was at how strong DePauw is, how this was a jewel of a college. I don't want this to be a hidden jewel. DePauw is stronger than what people know, and I'm going to tell the world about DePauw. I'm going to do it boldly, and I'm going to do it unapologetically. DePauw deserves no less than that. We've just begun a concerted effort to see how we can tell this story better. And we already have, with just a little bit of effort of telling the story, we've already seen one stunning result. By just changing our admissions material ever so slightly to highlight what is unique and great about DePauw, we saw our admissions efforts explode this year. When nearly every one of our peer institutions were struggling to enroll a sufficient number of students, we were instead surprised by the reaction to our offers of acceptance. We sent offer letters to our typical number of students, which should have yielded us 625 students. Imagine our surprise when in late April, when the letters came pouring in, 770 strong, of some of the brightest students in the Midwest and around the country. Yep. Every college president I run into is asking us what we did. My answer is always this: we just told the world how good we are. But beneath all these new planning efforts, I want you to know that I know that it's the old DePauw, the heart and soul of this place, that we're really celebrating. In addition to a year of planning and moving forward, this is a year in which we revived old traditions and created new ones that celebrate this grand old university. We made a joyful noise about DePauw this year. We welcomed our first years this year by assembling them together as a class outside of Lucy Rowland Hall. We then led them through a march through the gates by East College and into the opening convocation. The students were greeted there by faculty in full academic regalia, and as they marched across campus for the first time as students and as a class, the church bells of all of Greencastle's churches rang, just as they rang in 1832 when this town learned that it had the right to establish a Methodist college. This year, as it was done in the 1920s and 30s, we had a midnight pancake breakfast for students on the night of the Monon Bell. It was fun, I tell you. And this year, on the night before commencement, we lit up East College, we put lights in all the trees surrounding the lawns, and we had a campus-wide dance called DePauw Under the Stars for all the students and their families. I left the event a little before midnight, and the families were still gathering and dancing. And so, this has been a year of old and new, a year of looking forward while honoring the past. I ask you today, as in years past, to be part of this conversation, to thinking about what DePauw is and what DePauw can be. You are sitting here as graduates of one of the finest colleges and universities in this country. a place that will look forward with careful planning and with courage. But it's also a place that has ghosts in its buildings and echoes of generations of students who came here and were changed here. So if you will indulge me for just a moment, I would like for you right now to participate in one of my favorite DePauw traditions. When you graduated, as was the case for decades, the then president of the university offered a charge to the graduating class. We had our commencement just a few days ago, and I read this same and ancient charge to our newest graduating class. And as I read it, I thought it could still guide any lucky graduate of this wonderful university. I want you to remember this charge when you leave Greencastle yet again after this weekend, when you go out in the world one more time. You are DePauw, and you should remember what DePauw once asked of you and asks of you again as holders of DePauw degrees. So may I ask anyone here who is a DePauw graduate to please stand so I may charge you once again. Please. Young men and women. You have entered into a noble inheritance. You are heirs of all that is past. Prophets and sages, scholars and scientists, poets and public servants have wrought with patience and sought truth, and the abundant fruit of their toil is now yours. It is yours to use, it is yours to increase, it is yours to bequeath to your successors. The university charges you to be strong, to acquit yourselves with integrity, and to be loyal to your highest ideals. Whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are in good report, if there be any virtue, and if there be any praise, always think of these things. Dear alumni, I am honored to be with you. I am guided by your history, by your achievements, and your love for this place. I have had a thrilling year, and I promise you many more. Thank you.